Hello and welcome to another episode of Consumer, the European podcast of the Consumer Choice Center. I'm your host, Bill Wirtz, but only one half of your host today because I am joined by Fabio Fernandez, who you might know if you follow us on all the social media networks. He does a lot of the reels, and I wanted to get Fabio not just on for one episode, but I think we'll do this as a recurring theme. Once in a while, Fabio will be joining us and taking us together here through the Consumer Podcast, through the different issues, the news of the week or the month. So, Fabio, how goes it?
Howdy, everyone. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, it's really good to have you. And I think that, like, I'm quite honestly, I think your reels are very cool. It's like it's the type of video that appeals to a lot of people because it really gets straight to the point. I like the pop-up messages. I think that's really cool. Actually, how much work is it for you to produce one of these, like with the scripting, and just that our audience gets a bit of a feeling for how long it takes?
Yeah, actually, it looks pretty easy, but it goes a lot of work into producing those. So I need to create a script. First of all, I need to have an idea, right? Because it's the first step to know what I'm talking about. And the second thing is to script everything, and then I have to record it, edit, and finally post on our social accounts. And we're doing this actually because we want to have younger people listening to the content that we are creating. And we think that Reels, TikTok is where those young generations are and where we have to communicate with them.
Yeah, and I think like for the audience that wants to check out all of these videos, you can find them. I check them out on Instagram. I think that's kind of where this type of content is the most appealing. So please go and check that out on our social media channels. So different episode than we usually do. Usually it's just me and then I have a guest at the end of the episode and maybe some segments in between. Today, I really wanted to make it a conversation and then go back and forth between like our views on these topics. And first one, Fabio, I mean, you already made a video about this, the Universal Charger. Explain a little what is happening here. The European Union wants to do something with like our phone chargers. What's going on?
Yeah, so let me give you a little bit of background on that. So the European Union is calling that the Common Charger, and it's an effort that they are trying to bring in since 2009. And on September 23rd, the European Commission put forward this plan to have a universal charger.
Well, in Europe, a new rule is on the table that would force manufacturers to use a common charger. The EU says it would cut down on waste, save money, and really just be more convenient.
Et on a effectivement là une clé USB-C.
A little demo Thursday from the European Commissioner for Internal Market. He's got two phones that each need their own specific charger. It's a problem, he says, that the EU is working to solve with a world-first solution. Under the Commission's proposal, a USB-C connector, currently used for most Android devices, will become the standard port for all smartphones, tablets, cameras, headphones, portable speakers, and handheld video game consoles. And chargers will be sold separately from electronic devices. Apple has come out against the move. Its iPhones use a different lightning cable that wouldn't be compatible with the proposed universal charger. And the company says that strict regulation mandating just one type of connector stifles innovation rather than encouraging it.
But basically in 2009, we had 30 different chargers. And we need to remember that in 2009, smartphones were in its infancy. iPhone had only 2 years old. And but at that time, the European Commission was already pushing for a common and universal charger. But companies such as LG, Motorola, Nokia, Samsung, Sony Ericsson, even BlackBerry, Qualcomm, and Apple, at that time, they reached a voluntary agreement that is known as the Memorandum of Understanding. And on that agreement, they decided which was going to be the path forward in terms of chargers. So they basically decided on a handful number of chargers, including micro USB. But the problem there is that the micro USB was not at the same standard as Apple wanted to push its products. So it developed its own lightning cable, which is the common cable that we have nowadays for Apple. So what happened is that they enjoyed a loophole in the regulation that if companies were to offer adapters, they could keep using their proprietary chargers and proprietary cables. So Apple was using this to keep the its proprietary Lightning cable because they make a lot of money, right? They have the Made for Apple or Made for iPhone program where they can license the different type of cables, adapters, connectors. So they like using those. And in 2014, when the commission said again, okay, we need to have one type of cable, it was already too late because we have millions of devices using the Lightning cable. It's going to be too costly for the consumer, too inconvenient. And from that point on, we had this problem with mostly the companies are using USB-C and now moving to from micro USB now to USB-C, but Apple still uses the Lightning cable.
Yeah, I think it's like this conversation has been going on for a while now, and I think multiple commissions have worked on this. And it seems like such a typical European Union approach to the issue. It's sort of this is good for the consumer because then you don't have to buy all these, you know, cables, these different type of cables. But I mean, first of all, I think like if you're a freelancer, by tax purposes, you're incentivized to get new phones all the time. But most people actually keep their phone quite long, and this like switching between devices, like, okay, you have your micro USB because you get them with each and every product, so you'll have a few of those anyway. And then if you use an iPhone, you get your Lightning cable, and then you probably have whatever charger your MacBook uses or PC or whatever you're using. So ultimately, like, you don't really change these things that often. And by the time you change your device, we've kind of done an upgrade in like the cable infrastructure. Like, we've already upgraded how fast it charges and so on. So I'm not sure if you know this, how will it work if like there will be a USB-C plus cable coming out? Like, do then all the manufacturers have to convince the European Commission to create a new one, to create an upgrade and to introduce that as the universal charger? How does that work?
That's what we think is going to happen, because with the European Commission deciding what type of connector it's going to be, the universal charger, that might happen in the future. It's one of our concerns. So the first one is that the mandating of this new type of connector stifles innovation, because companies have no financial incentive to look for new types of cables. They are faster, better in any relevant or any meaningful way. And I think the main goal of the commission here is to fight e-waste. And they are worried because they say that over 1,000 tons of electronic waste every year is associated with cables and bricks that you use to charge your phone. But the big problem here is with Apple now having millions of devices, active devices in Europe that use the Lightning cable, doing this transition. And that goes to the next problem, which is a 24 months period that the commission is giving for consumers and companies to adapt. This is going to be terrible for consumers because it's a very short time. This is going to generate a lot of electronic waste because Apple users are going to throw their cables away when they switch phones. So I don't know if they are really fighting electronic waste here or they are just wasting money and the time of the consumer. And another thing that I think it's important for us to think about is that maybe in 5 or 10 years, we won't have cables anymore because we are moving to a wireless world. And so what is the point to do this now?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm again not sponsored, but if Apple wants to, they can. I got the new iPhone, and I hadn't figured out this like MagSafe, this like magnetic charging thing yet, because it's only been like since the iPhone 12 that they had this. You know, somebody like Thierry Breton, who is like the competition or single market commissioner, is like, I'm pretty sure that guy still uses the old like BlackBerry, the first generation, with like the old cables where every cable for every phone used to be different. And they're kind of stuck in this mindset, and they haven't really updated their knowledge about this because they're not actually the tech users. They're just the regulators, and their commission computers probably still works on Windows ME or XP, best case scenario. So like, they kind of haven't joined the mindset of like, well, there's always going to be a new innovation. We're going to charge this faster. We're going to have better batteries. I mean, I saw this recently. You probably saw this as well. They want to do something similar to the batteries in devices in general, so that the commission kind of wants that every battery in every device can be removed and changed with like a universal kind of battery. To me, it sounds like just as much of a disaster.
Yes, of course. And we are talking here about phones, but this regulation is going to affect tablets, cameras, headphones, portable speakers, handheld video game consoles. So like everything that is portable. And you can see that those products have different needs. They don't all need the same amount of power, the same amount of data transfer, and all kinds of things. So yeah, I think it's going to be a disaster also for this perspective. And when you talk about batteries, it's the same. So how long do you want your phone to last, and how long do you want your video game handheld console to last? Those are different products. They have different needs, and the commission doesn't know the technical details about those products. So they are the last person to be asked about those requirements. So
absolutely. And it's like, and it's also like, how do they imagine this happens? Is there, I sometimes feel like people in the mindset of some regulators, the companies are sort of like a monopoly man with a top hat and a cigar, and they're sitting there in the room together. It's like, ha ha ha, you know what we're going to do? We're all going to have different chargers, which is actually very inconvenient to most consumers, so that we can pollute the oceans more and sell more charging cables, which is not really where you make your money. I mean, charging cables used to be like an expensive thing because you needed a special one, but now the stuff is like so cheap. I it's just that these companies, again, as you said, like the products have different needs, and that's why there's different charging cables. And you know, sometimes you don't have the technology or the patents to get this technology, but ultimately I think right now what we see, the fact that Lightning and USB-C and micro USB are kind of the three that you need, already tells you a lot about how we've kind of innovated and standardized just as a commercial model, and sort of as a technical innovation.
And I'm wondering, what do you think about that? But also another downside that I see on this new regulation is that chargers will not be bundled with new devices, which means that when you buy your new iPhone or a new product, it's not going to come with a cable and not even with a brick. So we need to buy that separately, which also inconveniences consumers because the commission says that people have a drawer full of cables in their houses, which is not always true because some people, yeah, I don't think that.
I think that's kind of like, that's kind of the commission bureaucrat, you know, like you make your whatever five figures a month, and then yeah, you can get any device you want, you can buy all the device, and of course you, each time you get a cable, so eventually you have a drawer of cables. But most people are not like that, you know. Most people kind of get a phone when the old one breaks, and when the old one, like when they get a new phone, that phone will have a charger which didn't even exist back in the time when they got their last phone, and they want to have a cable. So it's this mindset. It's like a lot of these policies right now that I see. It's just like, it's the people in the city
solving personal problems.
Yeah, it's like the city ivory tower, and they can't even connect to how other people live. It just keeps happening. Let's go away from the charger. Let's go to the next topic. Maybe I'll play some sort of should I do like a new jingle or something? Maybe I should find a new jingle. Anyway, well, the listeners will hear that in the episode. Uber. Let's talk about Uber. We've talked about Uber quite a few times on this podcast. So there seems to be a lot of fights going on in Brussels. Now, I lived in Brussels for a while. And so it seems to be that for the first time, Uber's actually suspended its service in protest to the Brussels authorities. There's been back and forth about like how it's supposed to be regulated, and quite petty, the Brussels authorities have now said, I mean, this is the city, not the EU institutions, but the Brussels authorities have said that the drivers can't use their phone to organize a ride, which basically bans Uber. It's like, I mean, that's basically saying you can't have a commercial transaction done through your phone for mobility purposes, which it has a lot of implications. And I don't think it's constitutional or anything, but they'll have to fight it in the courts. But this keeps on going, this Uber conversation. Like, how long will we keep going with that? Fabio, like, I know that in Milan, where you live, it's also like heavily regulated. So that's why it's quite expensive to take a ride. What's your experience in your city?
Yes, I never use Uber here because it's very expensive, but also because it's not available. And this is one of the reasons that it's too expensive. Uber is based on a platform peer-to-peer, And the most you have in terms of offer of drivers on the street, the cheaper the service costs. And if you have less drivers, it costs more. It's a free market. So that's the beauty of using Uber and all those sharing economy apps. But yeah, here, I think that the taxi monopoly won because they literally have all the rights to do the transport of passengers. I personally don't use that too much. I go with public transport. I also love to use car sharing, which is very available here, and all the other sharing apps, whatever I have, like mopeds, all those kind of things. I love using those because taxes are expensive. The service is not great. It's a very outdated type of service. But I heard that in Brussels, you can explain a little bit more about that because I'm not too familiar with this information, but that was based on a law from the 1995 that, so it's a very outdated law. So a period of time, of course, that we didn't have Uber and not even smartphones. So
I mean, I can, yeah. So these laws are old and I can sort of understand where some of the taxi drivers come from. So you can have a taxi license based on your company. So your company buys a couple of taxi licenses, you give it to your drivers who are your employees. That's one option. Or you're a freelancer and then you purchase a taxi license for yourself, which are quite expensive. And then as an independent, you drive around. Now, then you have to make up for all the money that you paid to get the license in the first place. Now, Uber comes in and doesn't pay these licenses. So they drive around and then, you know, they don't have to make up the difference for the license costs. Now, I can understand how a taxi driver feels kind of screwed because, you know, you paid a lot of money for the license that apparently you didn't need in the first place because the Uber drivers just do it. But then you shouldn't be mad at the Uber drivers. You should kind of be mad at the people who made you pay all the money for the license in the first place. You know, that's the people you should kind of be upset at. And I think it should be the fair solution should be for the government to reimburse the pro rata expenses for the taxi drivers that paid and the companies that paid for the licenses and just be like, hey, there's no license anymore. We don't need licenses for hairdressers. We don't need licenses for butchers. None of these companies need licenses to regulate the amount of like supply there is on the market. So neither should you. Like there is sort of a flow of how many taxis are needed in a city, right? So yeah, I can understand how some of the drivers are mad, but the companies behind the taxi companies that actually organize in these kind of taxi unions, they are a problem because they keep lobbying the government to keep up these rules that ban Uber.
Yes, and they have some benefits with that. So they have, in most cities, special lines where they can drive, special parking, access to airports, train stations that sometimes Uber drivers don't have access to. And you don't see Uber drivers complaining about not having the same advantages and the same benefits as taxi drivers. So that's a question that we should ask because they have a lot of benefits that they get from the government for having those licenses.
Yeah, absolutely. And to an extent, of course, yeah, I mean, you also paid a certain amount, so you expect these advantages to be in place. But ultimately, for all the talk about marginalized communities, people with less accessibility to services, that happens constantly in the government. Uber provides a lot. I mean, it's not just Uber. It's like it's Bolt, all these different companies. Again, Uber, if you want to sponsor, please do. if take the example of like you can read a lot. I mean, even the New York Times had like pieces about this, about like how like black people, brown people, people of all different types of skin color really had a hard time in big American cities getting a taxi. It was really hard to get a taxi. And with Uber, you kind of solve that problem because Uber doesn't discriminate between different marginalized groups because they are believed to be problematic. So why we won't pick them up? Because you don't do it on site, you do it through the app. That's one thing. People with reduced mobility. Every other day, some municipality in where I live says like, oh yeah, we got to equip this and that with like, for people with reduced mobility, people in wheelchairs and so on. Uber gets people around to their destination and now you want to make that more expensive or less available and so on. So Uber provide a lot of solutions as well to the entire conversation of drunk driving. Drunk driving is an issue, especially in countries where public transport is not as developed. So people go and drink, then they take the car because the last bus has already left. With Uber, they don't have to do that anymore. It's a multitude of issues that are solved with this system. Also, I mean, I remember in Germany, we were in Munich and took this ride, and it's this guy from Iraq who, you know, he's a refugee. He doesn't speak the languages, and Uber is the best way to get into the labor market. It's labor market accessibility. But then, you know, the government, the labor unions, it's a threat to their bottom line, and that's why they don't like it.
Yeah, I agree with you on that. And we all love Uber. Consumers love Uber because it's a great experience. You know exactly how much you're going to pay. You know the rating of the driver. It's a self-controlled platform. So everyone controls everybody inside of this platform. So it's a self-regulated thing. And bureaucrats hate self-regulated things.
But now, Fabio, let's go to the last issue that I wanted to talk about, and it's one that, you know, usually economists go through, but let's try our luck, and that's inflation.
Shoppers in the Eurozone face a surge in prices. Inflation in the region hit a 10-year high in August. Price rises jumped to 3% this month, well above analyst forecasts and way clear of the European Central Bank's 2% target. Food prices and energy costs were among the big drivers, and the numbers will make uncomfortable reading for ECB economists. The central bank has repeatedly raised its inflation forecasts, only for the actual numbers to come in even higher. Even so, policymakers argue that one-off factors are driving the rise, and inflation will soon cool off. A muted market reaction to Tuesday's numbers suggests that investors buy that, for now at least. But with price rises in Germany projected to hit 5% in the coming months, long dormant memories of hyperinflation are being reawakened. When ECB policymakers next meet in early September, they will face tough questions and mounting pressure to act.
So inflation seems to be on the rise. There's a lot of indicators going to that, and I think you've done more of the research on that issue. But you know, there's a couple of clips that we'll also be playing throughout this segment. I know that in Luxembourg we have this indexation system. So this is when the government obliges companies to raise salaries as a result of inflation. So the indexation system right now means that people will have to be paid 2.5% more as a result of inflation. Does Italy have such a system? And kind of like also like, you know, what kind of views do you have on the current inflationary tendencies we have on the market?
I'm not sure about Italy. I know that in Brazil we have the same thing, and inflation in Brazil is also very high now. I think all over the world inflation is eating consumer power and consumer purchasing power, which is very worrying. And the news on inflation in Europe in general, according to Eurostat, is that September we're going to have an annual inflation of 3.4%, and it's it's above of what the target was. The target was 2%, and we're arriving at 3.4 annual inflation. And the main driver is energy. So the highest price in energy since 2008, it's 17.4% increase. And Germany also has one of the biggest increases in terms of prices, 4.1%, the highest in 30 years. Italy energy prices are expected also to increase 40% this year. I received already a lot of notifications saying the next month, maybe 40% increase in my bill. So central banks say that this inflation will ease in 2022, so next year. But for now, I see that the winter is going to be very expensive for all of us.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I spent most of my time in Turkey last year. And, you know, Turkey is a country where you really see inflation in real time, because then you have an inflation of like 30 to 35%. There you go to an exchange office and you can see the lady, she has to change the numbers on the exchange rates every day. So it's been more creeping in Europe. It's not as noticeable. But then, you know, sort of your digital subscriptions, they go up in price, and you can kind of see like this slight increase. And then, of course, the valid criticism is that people, you know, your your salaries don't grow as quickly as the money inflates. And I think that's why people buy crypto. And I think that's why it keeps being interesting. What you said about the energy market is just very true. I mean, I think you know, I gave this interview to this French newspaper, Atlantico, and it's like the wind wasn't blowing as well in Germany last year. They're going to shut down 3 more nuclear power stations in, December this year. And then the 3 last ones that will be remaining in December 2022, those will be shut down. And as a result, Germany has the highest electricity prices in Europe. And of course, that reflects on the consumers. And it's regressive, you know, because the people on the lowest incomes have the highest comparable expenditure on energy. So it's not just the pandemic. It's all like, let's see, that the government induced restrictions around the pandemic. It's also all the other stuff at the same time. You know, when the commission says, well, coronavirus is a big issue and we're going to spend our way out of this, but also we can't give up on our green ambition. So all of this raises the prices for consumers. It keeps on going and they don't really seem to realize where the causes lie.
Yes, exactly. It makes recovery even harder for businesses, for consumers. It was a very hard time for us the past 18 months here in Europe, a lot of lockdowns, as you mentioned. So terrible times. And knowing that in the next couple of months, you're going to have a 20% increase, 30, 40% increase in your energy bills, it's going to be a big blow in all consumers and all households' budget. So it's very worrying. And we talk about only, I'm talking here about energy prices and bills for households, but also energy prices affect everything, affect the prices of everything that we produce, everything that is sold on supermarkets. So it's a chain of events that will ultimately increase prices in every area of the economy. And as you said, energy, it's something that we need to think about. The Commission is thinking about, the EU is thinking about how to diversify a little bit in terms of energy, the energy mix. But we are still too dependent in Russia. So I have some data here. For example, in terms of oil, we import 27% from Russia. In terms of coal, it's 46%. And in terms of gas, it's 41%. And then we have Iraq, Nigeria, Saudi Arabia, Kazakhstan, and other places. But we are too dependent in Russia in terms of the import of natural resources.
I mean, by the way, being dependent on Kazakhstan or Azerbaijan isn't much better than being dependent on Russia.
Not at all. But 74% of the energy we produce in Europe is based on fossil. Only 9% or almost 10% is nuclear, and 16% is renewables. So we are too dependent also in fossil, and being dependent in fossil and then being dependent on importing those materials and this from other countries, that's even worse. So we need to rethink the energy mix in Europe.
Oh, absolutely. And then when we look at the renewables, I remember being in Brussels and you're talking to somebody from the wind power energy lobby, whatever. And, you know, when you talk to them, honestly, they tell you that unless it's offshore, there's no scenario in which the onshore wind power will exist in a non-subsidized way. And that's a glaring admission, because, I mean, who is it subsidized by? Who might be paying for it? I just got my tax return in Luxembourg. I got to pay extra as well. And it's like, I don't know. It's so short-sighted. And again, it's what we said earlier. It's a bit like with the cable thing. It's like the people who can afford to buy the newest of everything, they get all the cables, and they're like, I mean, everybody must have a drawer full of cables because they keep buying the new stuff. So this must be a problem that everybody deals with. It's so disconnected. It keeps being so disconnected. And then when people look for solutions, they buy crypto. It's like, oh, now we got to regulate crypto. And then people, you know, advocate for nuclear energies. Oh no, you're evil! Like, you're defending the whatever. I know the French, Valéry Giscard d'Estaing, when he was president in the 70s, he introduced nuclear energy to get energy independence for France. Which, I mean, who thought that Giscard could make such a lucid decision? And not only did they do that, they also, if you compare Germany and France on carbon dioxide emissions, which is what everybody seems to be interested in right now, those are reduced constantly in France, while Germany keeps missing its CO2 emissions targets. So not only does it cost a lot for consumers, it also actually doesn't achieve the goals that we were set out to achieve in the first place. So this is a loop that keeps on going. And now, like, when countries want to spend on, you know, creating nuclear energy plants in order to deal with the climate change phenomenon, then they now there's the environmental groups that want to tell them, no, you can't do that under the EU budget rules. So all the billions that we're now borrowing to spend on the recovery will be spent on inefficient ways of producing energy, which is wind and solar. And I don't know. When are they going to notice that this doesn't work?
Yes, and France is 51% dependent on fossil as an energy source, and Germany is 77%, as you were saying. So you can see the difference and why Germany has a higher increase in their consumer prices now with inflation. And the demand for energy is going to grow and grow more every year, especially now that we are pushing for electric cars, electric vehicles. The demand is going to increase, and we need to rethink for consumers what is the best way to move forward and keep that sustainable.
Well, that sounded like a great conclusion there. I think we're at the end of our time on the first time that Fabio Fernandes joined us here on the Consumer Podcast. First of all, Fabio, thank you so much. Sorry about the technical issues. I mean, the listeners will not notice, but we had to edit a few times because like three of my different devices ran out of battery while recording. Fabio, you didn't have that issue, so that's great.
Yeah, but I'm honored to be here. Thank you for having me, Bill. I hope to keep the standard of this podcast high, which is it is. And it's a very respectable podcast. People love hearing you talk about European issues. So I hope I can contribute a little bit to this conversation.
Where do people follow you on Twitter, Fabio?
They can follow me on De Faria e Silva, which is the Portuguese, my middle name. But also, if you go to the Consumer Choice Center, Consumer Choice C, you can find me. We usually retweet everything that we do.
So we've been your co-hosts, Fabio Fernandes and Bill Wirtz, on this episode of the Consumer Podcast. Thank you so much for listening and see you Thursday. You have to learn to pace yourself. Pressure. You're just like everybody. You won't